The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Well, welcome back as we head into hour three. It's a delight to do so with our good friend, our dear friend, Lewis Holman. He usually joins his dad, Hugh, on Tuesdays with us. But Hugh is out of town, out of state, out of country. He'll be back with us, I believe, next week. So delighted to have Lewis with us, with me. Lewis Holman is the managing director of Insight Analytics, LLC. Insight is I-N-C-I-T-E. Lewis, welcome back.
Seth, it's always a pleasure. Although it's fun that you said I'm here with us. You know, you just finished chiding young David that the only people who should be using first-person plural pronouns are royalty and people with tapeworms. Are you afflicted with such a thing?
No. Are you including me?
Ah, I see.
Yeah, no, I was thinking you and me. I'm allowed to use first-person plural in radio because we have an audience.
That's true.
Well.
That's true. We do.
And young David is part of that. He's attached to it, whether he wants to be or not.
I am also your audience.
So
yeah.
Royalty, people with tapeworms, and radio hosts.
All right. Yeah, which is in the newspaper editor category.
That's true.
Yeah, I think it's we can speak royally as editors and people without tapeworm. Okay, anyway, you're a student of philosophy and history.
Such as it is.
Yeah, you're also a student of education. And a couple hours ago in my monologue, I was talking about this story, and we've seen variations on it, of this this education high school program for the gifted that they are going to be lowering the standards because it turns out they're not attracting enough people in this gifted program, honors and gifted program, from DEI categories, I suppose one might say.
Yeah, that stuff kills me. It really does. And it kills me for two reasons. First of all, that by artificially lowering the standards of the gifted and accelerated programs, we are denuding those programs of their very purpose, right? They're supposed to be accelerated and difficult, and the very point that they are is so that the kids in them, those that need that extra stimulation and need that extra attention and have the ability to put in the kind of work that can be rewarded in that way, those kids are rare. And those are the kinds of kids who can go on to change the world in some ways. You know, they're very, very valuable. And we should not squander them in the name of hurt feelings and making people feel better. You know, one of my largest irritations with education in this country is not really a partisan issue, and it's the fact that for the last 2.5 decades, we have spent an absolutely inordinate amount of time thinking about the left-hand side of the distribution, which is to say the kids that are slowing down and not
it's where the bulk of the spending goes, too.
It's true.
Yeah.
And we spend no time at all talking about the kids that are struggling on the right-hand side, the ones that are excelling, but then bored, unmotivated, and then who are then not being socialized adequately. Those kids are abandoned, and we leave them behind. We ignore their abilities, and we refuse to till that garden at our peril. And that we would not only that the board is already so wildly in favor of remedial education instead of advanced education is alarming, but to then further take what little opportunity exists for advanced education and destroy it for those that would be able to take advantage of it is just it's hurtful to me beyond belief. You know, I was so lucky growing up as a kid. I got access to some really unique educational opportunities as a result of Arizona's very, very robust charter school system. I went to a local school called Tempe Prep, wherein students were admitted via lottery. So random sample. About, I think, 1 in 7 kids who applied got in because there was so much demand for the school. But my graduating class was only 50 kids. But, you know, in that, I got to learn calculus, physics, chemistry, Latin, Greek, humane letters, philosophy, you know, all sorts of things that in public school, you know, you wouldn't get the opportunity to do normally.
Mm-hmm. And in a traditional public school.
Well, right, right. And that's one of the reasons it's so critically important that children be allowed to be placed where they can have the greatest success, and that parents be empowered, the people on the ground, because we say this all of the time, that the best way to make decisions is as locally as possible. And who is more local to the development and socialization of a child than one's parents? Mm-hmm. Ultimately, the decision on where and how to educate that child should be left up to those parents, who can then find appropriate resources that work with their logistical work schedule and their ability to transport the child. Having the state coordinate everything and then dump all of the money on the sad sack cases to the impoverishment of all of the rest of us intellectually and culturally is a shame.
That raises so many questions. A, it raises the question, what do you do with the left hand? What do we want to call this? The left hand, the underperforming students? Yeah, well, the underperforming students. It raises the question, how do we get underperforming to performing? Mm-hmm. That's question one.
Sure.
You're absolutely right. We have not asked in a serious or national way about the other hand, about the high excelling students, except to kill off their programs. And so how do we get more of them? In fact, how do we get the adequate performing into that group is perhaps yet a third question, into the high performing group. You know, when we do these national assessments, you're familiar perhaps with the National Assessment of Educational Progress. It's known as the nation's report card. They have scoring categories based on any number of areas of curricula they test in. They have basic, they have proficient, and they have advanced. Mm-hmm. And everyone thinks everyone thinks that proficient is where you want people. It isn't. Proficient is basically C+ operations.
Right, correct.
It's basically C or C+. Mm-hmm. No one talks about the advance. And the distribution there, as you can imagine, is small, very small.
It's tiny, yeah.
It's tiny. The tragedy is that there is a category that they have taken away that used to be on there called below basic.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you can figure out what it is because it's whatever the numbers –
right,
that don't add to 100%. The below basic is F.
Mm-hmm.
And the percentages that are in the below basic categories are in some cases 40 and 50%.
And in some cases significantly higher than that. There are some school districts predominantly urban in, say, Baltimore or Chicago.
Yeah,
in
sure.
Which, you know, there are four
national,
or five,
yeah,
or six,
no,
schools,
you're right,
in,
you're right,
total without,
no,
a single student.
No one is performing at basic. No one is performing at basic, which is,
right, appalling.
Appalling, which is C minus C.
So you brought up a lot of stuff there.
Well, but there's yet – yes. Okay. I have more to bring up.
Okay.
But go ahead. You take it wherever you want.
Well, the first thing that you asked was about moving kids not only that are potentially not performing well and getting them to perform adequately, but potentially taking those that are performing adequately and making them exceptional. Here is the really hard part of that conversation. The literature, the scientific literature on student achievement and performance, particularly in terms of things like improving cognition, is very dismal. It doesn't look good. We spent a lot of money as a nation and as a society and a lot of resources on things like Head Start in the W. Bush administration and which have then sort of continued thereafter. And despite, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars spent, you know, all of the conclusions from those programs were that the effects were negligible and disappeared within effectively a year or two. And most of what seems to be coming out of the clinical literature indicates that by the time you are able to really have a conversation with the child, it's probably too late to move the needle except down,
yeah,
right? That's also sort of the scary thing about dealing with and raising children, is that they're fragile in a sense that, you know, it's sort of like an egg. Like, you can't improve it in any way, but it's very easy to break.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. You can not only is it easy to break. Eggs an interesting thought. I was thinking cucumbers and pickles.
Okay, yeah,
I was thinking
one,
that
but,
a pickle
right.
can never become a cucumber again.
Sure, okay.
Which is why we kind of think about early loading and mm-hmm. early literacy. Let me take a commercial break. Let's come back on that and let's talk about. It also is with regard to higher education and Fall
State. I actually have a lot there. I want to talk about my experience in higher education.
Oh, I bet
you do. I think it's very relevant here.
I thought you might. Lewis Hallman is my guest. Lewis is L-O-U-I-S. Hallman is self-evident. Insight Analytics, I-N-C-I-T-E, L-L-C. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Lewis Hallman is my guest. We've put a lot on the table with education. Can I throw one more thing in?
Please.
It's this odd phenomenon that has struck education, and I suppose I can figure out why. But, you know, you were speaking about early education and the finances we've put into the kind of Head Start programs
right,
and
right.
the analyses of that shows negligible results. There's this phenomenon of passing on that everyone has known about for 50 years. Mm-hmm. But what they haven't really quite gotten their heads around is what it means, and what it means for the teachers as much as for the students. Because what it means is every teacher is assuming what needs to be done will be taken care of in the next step, in the next year, in the pass along. So more and more is being loaded upwards. It's kind of like a reverse. What are those Russian dolls called?
Matryoshka dolls.
Yeah, it's kind of a reverse Matryoshka doll system where you're actually increasing the burden as
right.
on the teacher as the age goes up. And it's not getting done. And it not only leads to illiterate citizens and illiteracy generally, it leads to a fraud on academia such that you get the kind of idiocy you see. Maybe the right word is learned ignoramus. The learned ignoramuses you see in the college presidents that have become famous of late. You wonder how someone like a Claudine Gay with such a thin record of scholarship, such a thin record that wouldn't even really get her assistant professor at a school most people hadn't heard of, can become the president of Harvard. That's an example. But that example is infused throughout higher education, with rare exception. Anyway, I'm putting more on.
No, absolutely.
I'm loading you up.
I'd like to actually tell you a little bit about my experience in higher education. So I attended a school called Claremont McKenna. I believe you are familiar with that place.
As is your dad.
Yep, as is my father. And an interesting thing, I think, occurred between the time that you and Dad attended and the time that I went, and it is sort of the closing of the American mind style, very much in left defying of the universities. Because when you attended, I believe Claremont McKenna was one of those rare, still remaining kind of middle of the road institutions where conservatism was not an automatic moral failing on one's part.
I'll go better. I'll go one better. The poli-sci department, known as the government department, was known as one of the few conservative departments in the country.
Yep. And
maybe one of two. I can't even think what the other might be.
And I will tell you that is absolutely or was absolutely no longer the case
right.
by the time I arrived on
right.
campus in about 2011.
Correct.
And it was fascinating to see, really. And so You've outlined a really sort of a dire state of affairs, but I want to kind of ask ourselves, why does it happen, right? Why do children – why do teachers allow themselves to fail their charges so spectacularly and in so often and in so repeatable a fashion? And I think it comes down to this Jonathan Haidt concept that we've talked about, the moral foundations that cause people to operate. Well, many people that are teachers have master's degrees. They skew very, very highly educated, and they themselves are recent products, by and large, of the sort of closing of the American mind, leftification of the university system. So we have a teaching population that then skews left and is then therefore very, very subject to those ideals that drive the left, namely harm reduction, but especially fairness. Now, how would that apply? Now, obviously, it seems obvious to us that not preparing someone to read is harmful to them in the long run. But how do they see it? The teacher that works with that person day in and day out sees the struggles, sees the person embarrassed, sees them shy, sees them struggling, and looks to correct the immediate discomfort rather than the long-term issue, right? Hiding and papering over the problem. If I don't force you as a 15-year-old who has never learned to read, like, if I don't make you confront that emotion, that's a hard emotion to confront, I would imagine, right?
Yeah.
That's got to be tough, right? Like, there's got to be shame and embarrassment.
At 15?
Right.
Because we used to say third grade was the tipping.
But that's a real scenario for people.
Of course it is.
Right?
Of course it is.
Like, how humiliating would it be, do you think, to like have to be at that point?
Right.
And so, very empathetically, I imagine, a lot of teachers probably don't want to open those wounds.
Right?
The other thing that's happening is...
Nor do they want to open up the wound of looking at the school district that they work in where that has transpired and allowed to take happen.
Well, it also might imply, like, very few people are able to look at the results of their work and conclude that they are bad at their jobs.
Right.
That is a rare thing.
Yeah.
Then sort of the other thing again is again coming off of, so we have harm reduction, right? Minimizing the emotional hurt. But then we also have the notion of fairness, right? Mm-hmm. Let's keep in mind that it's very common on the left and for the left to be culturally informed by the notion of a tabula rasa. A human is a blank slate. That society is the cause of all of one's ills and woes. And so this 15-year-old who is illiterate, it's not his fault that he's illiterate either. He has been failed. And so because it's not his fault, we can't punish him by holding him back. It's only just of us to correct the failure and push him through the system.
Right.
That's the logic that happens. It is twisted and it is warped, but you can see the sense of it. So how do we argue against it? I'd like to share some of the things that I saw in Claremont, which then, by the time that I attended, had a fairly significant pressure for diversity, equity, and inclusion, including a pressure to enroll African-American students with significantly lower test scores and incoming GPAs than non-African-American students.
But,
and this had huge implications among the student body and was very, very damaging.
I want to come to that in earnest, but just along the way, do you remember at Claremont, it may or may not have been true, I just don't know if you knew, did they have remedial courses?
So they did have remedial courses.
See this? Okay, this. Okay.
Yep.
Go on.
Yep. So yeah, Claremont was a little.
There's
weird.
No reason. There's okay. Go on.
They.
How do you get in if you need a remedial course? This is question one.
Right.
Okay.
So absolutely.
Because they're turning down people who don't need remedial courses.
So let me paint the picture. The average entrant to that school when I got in had was in the top 1% of the SAT and typically in the top 5% of their graduating class GPA-wise.
Sounds about right.
Very, very high, hard school to get into. Now, the African-American students that got in, on average, instead of having a 3.7 GPA, they might have had a 3.3 GPA. And instead of getting 700s on their SAT, they got 600s on their SATs. That's still a good score. Across all three tests, that's an 1,800. That's better than 85% of the students. But it's not the same as being better than 99% of the students.
Hold that thought. We'll come back to it when we come right back. Lewis Holman is my guest, and we will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Lewis Holman is my guest. We're talking education today. Okay, Lewis, go right ahead. So there's a basic, a DEI effort at the admissions level of these once elite universities.
Absolutely. And you see a bifurcation in the scores of incoming students. As I was saying before the break, African-American students who were entering Claremont when I did typically got about a 600 on their SATs, which is an excellent score, better than about 80-85% of the population. And their GPAs were similar. The non-African American students who got into Claremont though had were in the top percent of the SAT, and their GPAs were sort of commensurate with that. And so what ended up happening is we had a large African American student body that was largely then not operating on the same academic level as the other students.
Someone forgot to tell the professors at some point.
Well, not only did that cause GPAs to suffer, right. You saw about 40% of African-American students in academic delinquency at any given point, which was a huge problem for the student, you know, for the school, and they thought was very embarrassing. And they then found themselves unable to keep up, and, you know, for those that were, because there were so many that were not, they always then found themselves in that position of, if, you know, is this one of the, you know, one of those that is then struggling or not, right? And so the default assumption sort of unfairly, I would say, turns towards, oh, this person must be struggling. So not only do you get sort of an unfair stereotype, but the whole point of this, right, was to give these kids the best and brightest of their classes and their opportunities to put them and give them the ability to access an elite college environment where they might thrive. The problem is that then they show up, they aren't at the same level of the other students, they're not prepared for the work, and so they spend 4 years buried, frustrated, miserable, and increasingly resentful.
Possibly on a 5 or 6 year plan.
And feeling increasingly patronized by the institution the entire time. Where instead, if they had just gone to an aggressively good state school, something that is just like, you know, a Caltech or something like that, something that was
slump for 2 years to get ready.
Something that was right sized for their abilities. They would have been A students. They would have been set up for success, and they would have had a very, very different experience.
Is there a small distribution of this underperforming population that, when you put into a rigorous environment, will in fact bloom, blossom, and meet it?
So that comes back to a couple of sections ago when we were talking about, and this is really, the literature for this is more at the grade school level. Once people get to become adults, you have a lot more agency and a lot more self-sorting, right? The people that should, like, you know, once you're in the 400-level calculus class in university, you probably like math, right? There's no way to just throw someone who doesn't like math into that and get them into it. But as far as the younger kids, yes, it is true. It is generally only true on the extreme right-hand side of the distribution. If you've already got a smart kid who was bored out of his skull and utterly unchallenged and unmotivated, if you can give him structure, or maybe it's not that he's unmotivated, maybe he doesn't care, he's got something else going on. If you can frame the lesson in such a way that it sparks his interest, maybe he really likes dinosaurs, and now we're turning the math into a paleontology lesson about carbon dating to teach him exponents.
Have to be basics and proficiencies to begin with.
Right. But you know, without those fundamentals, it is, you can't get anything. And I've spent a lot of time, and I still do. I do a lot of before I started management consulting and working as a statistician, I taught SAT, ACT, GMAT, GRE, and then graduate and college level subjects to people. A lot of it math. And even if I was teaching graduate students mathematics, the number one study aid I give them is arithmetic flashcards. Because if you do not understand the fundamentals, everything else is more of a struggle. The way to get really, really good at the really, really hard stuff is to have the really easy stuff so mastered that it's not even a thought.
So there's three things I want to do with you, and you may have a fourth and a fifth when we come back on the other side of this break. I want to talk about a misplaced privilege. Often people will say, well, they didn't grow up with the same privileges based on ethnicities and environments. I have a feeling that there is a privilege, but I think it has to do with parents and families. I want to go back to the Harrison Bergeron story of Kurt Vonnegut's, and I want to talk to you about ed schools generally. Lewis Holman is my guest. He and I will be right back. Welcome back to the Seth Leibson Show. Lewis Holman from Insight Analytics, my guest, talking education. Envision a small school where you had faculty that you selected, and you could have someone like your dad teaching economics.
I'd rather have someone like me do it, but okay.
Well, I was going to have you teaching math.
Fair enough.
I was going to have your dad teaching economics or civics. Young David could teach a course on English. Pardon any vainglory. Maybe I could teach a course or something on some area in the humane letters. We don't get teachers like that at scale in schools where they're needed. And So part of the reason, well, let me lay this out. Part of the reason is neither your dad nor you nor young David nor I would want to waste our time at a teacher's getting a graduate degree in education, which is increasingly where we're forcing would-be teachers to go. Daniel Buck, who's an education reform scholar, had a piece, and I'll just give you this. I studied for a master's degree in education. My program was batty. We made Black Lives Matter friendship bracelets. We passed around a popsicle stick to designate whose turn it was to talk while professors compelled us to discuss our life's traumas. We read poems through the lenses of Marxism and critical race theory in preparation for our students doing the same. Our final projects were acrostic poems or ironic rap videos. At the time, I figured my experience was unique. The more I looked around, the more common I saw it was. Now, someone like your dad, you, David, myself, we would just have no patience with that kind of education. But that is what teachers are going through to become classroom ready.
That is accurate, yes. In most cases, that is what they have to do. There are exceptions. Again, Arizona has an increase, like a very robust charter school movement. Tempe Prep, the school where I attended, does not require its teachers to have education degrees. I was taught physics by a man who had his doctorate in optics but did not have an education master's degree.
Right.
And I think I benefited from that.
Right. Public schools won't hire him.
Absolutely. No. And he did, I think, 20 years working for one of the big three auto manufacturers.
I had a former congressman friend. A former congressman who became a newscaster, then became a congressman for something like 15 years, retired and wanted to move back to the state of Oregon to be with his grandchildren, and thought he might make a good government or civics teacher at the high school level.
Wow.
Without certification, this newscaster congressman was not qualified to teach these young charges civics. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, it is absolutely. Correct. It is the regulatory state run amok, right? You know, I wonder at this point, is it a guardrails thing? Because I'm struck by the notion that the entity that is most in favor of these provisions, these guardrails, are not parents, are not the students, it's the teachers' unions, right? This is a cartel that is protecting its inefficient members.
I think there's also two views of education that are taking place here, and we're talking past one another, not you and I in the audience,
sure.
But the two views of education are talking past one another. I think some people think education, probably most people in this audience and families such as yourself and mine, where we think, okay, you go to school to become educated, learn a little English, learn a little math, geography, and the like. There's a different view of education that I think has taken over the cartel, mm-hmm. and it's not that so much as it is to teach what Daniel Buck was writing about, to think of education as a subversive activity, as one writer once wrote a book about it, or the education of the pedagogy of the oppressed, this Paulo Ferrer Marxist notion that the point of education is ideological, not instructional.
Well, education is socialization more than it is anything else.
So that's the other view.
And when I say socialization, I of course mean nothing to do with socialism, but in that it teaches us how to act in and around a society.
Mm-hmm.
But part of the issue, part of the ideological captivation of teachers broadly, and part of the institutional push to ensure that that happens, I think means that they feel a compunction, right? So if you are of the opinion that progress is an inevitable and a good thing, and the arc of history is just and bends, you know, upwards.
Always.
And that...
Always upwards. Yeah.
Right.
Right.
And that, you know, the common lefty phrases are the key to unlocking a better world. And you sincerely and earnestly believe that without having critically thought through all of the rest of the presuppositions that go along with it, then the people that oppose you are quite rightly evil maniacs.
Yeah. Right.
Right. Right. And you have a duty then to shape the children of those maniacs and make them like you, you know, so that you can bring about this better world.
Right.
Right. It is entirely internally consistent.
It's so interesting. Yeah, that's a good way of put it. I was talking with a guest last week. They're trying to make the students like them, not like themselves.
Correct.
Now, I did mention this in passing, and I didn't want to let it go because I do think it is a big part of this. When we – and perhaps the reason – programs like Head Start show such diminishing returns is we have focused on the wrong, quote unquote, kinds of privilege. I do think there is a two-parent privilege. I think that might be the most important indicator of how a child will perform in school, beyond economics, beyond neighborhood, beyond zip code, beyond per pupil expenditure.
It certainly is up there with one of the most impactful measures. And like we were talking about earlier, it's very hard to improve children, but it's very easy to break them.
Yeah.
And while, you know, all else equals, everyone having a two-parent household may not produce a staggeringly lot more geniuses, it may produce a lot fewer people that feel broken and alone and isolated and unable to contribute to our society meaningfully.
Yeah, right. And at any number of levels, because it does impact the economics of the household, mm-hmm. if that's not too tautological, it does impact the time on task with the student being forced to do homework, mm-hmm. And forced to be accountable for their failures, as well as rewarded for the successes. And it also, go ahead.
More than anything else, we also talked about the fact that so much of this stuff is, you know, the pre-3
right.
stage,
right.
and it's also one more people, you know, one more person in the house to get that infant those crucial 6 million words before the age of 3. If you have one person in the house who also has to work and also has other things going on, it's a lot harder to get that concentrated amount of communication to an infant. It's a lot easier with 2 people.
Yeah.
And the actual, you know, it is the oppression of time itself, right, that is really the problem here, because that is what ultimately is so difficult here. It's the notion that there is no such thing as a free lunch, not because you can't get your lunch paid for, but because opportunity costs exists, and that by eating that lunch, you are giving up something else, some other opportunity.
Nice. Thank you, Lewis Holman. We'll be right back. Talking about education, people are always looking for resources and where to go. There's any number of them, and people can obviously email me or Lewis for help. In one of his early speeches as the Secretary of Education under Ronald Reagan, William Bennett said, "Let me aspire to suggest the shape of the obvious as to what our children should know, starting with the humanities in our schools. It is important to know what justice is, what courage is. It is important to know what is noble and what is base. It is important to know what deserves to be defended and what deserves to be loved. In the words of Montaigne, it is important to know the difference between ambition and greed, between loyalty and servitude, between liberty and license, and more. Every student should know how mountains are made, and that for every action there is an equal and opposite reaction. They should know who said I am the state and who said I have a dream. They should know about subjects and predicates, about isosceles triangles and ellipses. They should know where the Amazon flows and what the First Amendment means. They should know about the Donner Party and slavery, and Shylock and Hercules and Abigail Adams, and where Ethiopia is and why there was a Berlin Wall. They should know a little of how a poem works and how a plant works and what it means to remark that if wishes were horses, beggars would ride. They should know the place of the Milky Way in DNA and the unfolding of the universe. They should know something about the Constitutional Convention and about the conventions of good behavior. They should know a little of what the Sistine Chapel looks like and what great music sounds like." Why can't we have schools like that, Lewis?
Well, because as we've said before, schools are about socialization, not about teaching you things. And so much of our polity has decided that they would like to impart their vision of society through schools, and that schools should be a vehicle for learning about the way that the world ought to be. So much of his discussion was about values and about virtues yep. and about ethics, right. not even about fact.
Right.
And so that is the key part of the socialization component that we should be thinking about. When I ask us what kind of Americans we want to be in the future, this is what I'm talking about. What values do we want to expand and extrude into the depths of the 21st century? Because right now, there is a very loud and very entrenched group of people who certainly have a vote.
Yeah.
And their vote is that they would like things to run DEI, long arc of history bend towards justice, everything should be a revolution. We have to act now and tear down Western civilization. That is effectively the argument. Western civilization is an unjust enterprise that has not brought good to the world. And as a Westerner, I reject this notion. I think that Aristotle was right. The greatest virtue was magnanimity, because the powerful, those with unchecked ability to influence our lives, they need to show discretion and mercy. And if we can't create a society that encourages that, then we are doomed.
Lewis Holman, thank you very much. On behalf of Mr. Bill and Young David and Terry and the rest, I am Seth Leibson. Until tomorrow, God bless you all, and
class dismissed.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.